Demodulate, episode one. Demodulate, a show about hacking and freaking in the 1980s and 1990s. On this episode, we're going to be talking about X25 networks and the hackers who hacked on those networks. So, let's go. Hello, I'm Beav, and welcome to the first episode of Demodulate. Today we're going to be talking about hacking on X25 networks. But you might be asking yourself, what are X25 networks, and why are we talking about them? In the 1970s and early 80s, X25 networks were some of our first attempts at global computer networking. There were networks like ARPANET and NFSnet, but these were primarily used by universities and some non-classified military applications. The X25 networks that we're going to be talking about today had multiple uses, including commercial applications. Unlike ARPANET, most X25 networks were corporate-based. You had global X25 networks in the United States. These included things like Telenet, that's T-E-L-E-N-E-T, and TimeNet. In France, you had Transpac. In Canada, you had DataPac. Airline companies even had their own X25 networks, known as CITA, that's S-I-T-A. So basically, these were networks that were mostly corporate entities that were running them. At the time, these networks had some of the most interesting things in the world connected to them. Now, remember, this is pre-Linux days, and it seemed like at the time, every computer manufacturer out there had some sort of operating system. So you had things like Unix, but you also had Primes and Digital Equipment Corporation Vaxen running VMS and various IBM mainframes and terminal servers, and you name it. This sort of diversity and connectivity attracted hackers. It allowed hackers to connect to a plethora of machines across the globe for free, and free being the key word here. You have to remember, in the 1980s, a long-distance phone call was ridiculously expensive. For example, a call to Germany from the United States in the 1980s was around $3 to $4 per minute. Using and exploiting X25 networks allowed a hacker to connect around the world to systems for free, or at least on somebody else's tab. One of the holy grails to find on an X25 network was an outdial modem. That is, a modem that was connected to the network that you could use. So imagine you're sitting at a computer in Tallahassee, Florida, in the United States. By calling a local phone number, and then through a few simple commands through the X25 network, you could be using a modem in Los Angeles. Once connected, you would simply use the modem's Hayes command set to take control of the modem and call wherever you wanted to. This was insanely valuable back then. Another interesting fact is that two X25 networks might not even behave the same way, and yet be interconnected. This led to a maze of fun and discovery at the time. That's why we're talking about X25 hacking today. We'll be discussing the lost art of X25 exploration and hacking on it with some of the most notable X25 hackers around. But before we jump in, there's going to be some terms about X25 thrown around that you might not be familiar with. So let's do a quick rundown of some of the most common terms so you recognize them as the show progresses. Okay, number one, the pad. Also known as a packet assembler disassembler, this is where you'd interact with the X25 network. Typically, as a X25 hacker, you would dial into an X28 pad and be greeted with a prompt. Some pads didn't even require you to log in, though it would restrict what you could do once you connected to the network. Once connected, you can instruct the pad what you'd like to do. So for instance, if you want to set your terminal settings, you could do that there. You could also instruct the pad to connect to other addresses within the network. As an X25 hacker, you spend a lot of time on the pad. Depending on the network you are targeting, the pad dial-up might be published by the telecommunication company that operates the X25 network. Bull numbers would also float around on hacker BBSs as well. You can think of the pad as the entry point into the X25 network that would allow you to move and communicate with hosts within that network. Number two, NUI, or an NUI, also known as a network user identification. This is a password that gives you access or special privileges to the X25 network. Some networks like Telenet and TimeNet didn't even require an NUI, but would restrict your communications within the network. X25 networks worked very similar to phone systems at the time. So the idea was that you were making a, quote, call, quote, to a remote system on the X25 network. Somebody had to, quote, pay for that call. Who paid for the call was typically determined by the NUI. So obviously having an NUI, while not always necessary, was sought after by X25 hackers. Number three, DNIC, or Data Network Identification Code, and this is a fun one. This is a X121 addressing format that consisted of a 3-digit country code plus a network digit. When all the digits were put together, they were known as a Data Network Identification Code, or DNIC, and it works like this. France had a 3-digit data country code, or DCC, of 208. If you wanted to communicate with France's Transpac X25 network, that was 2080. Let's say you wanted to communicate with the X25 network that Air France operated. That would be 2084. Germany's DCC was 262. So if you wanted to connect to Germany's DATXP, that was at 2624. And this is where Hans, who you hear from later on the show, was connecting from to break into a lot of computers in the United States. Now, most countries only had one DCC. There's an exception to that, which is, of course, the United States. The United States had many X25 networks. So the United States DCC was 3102316. If you wanted to connect to, say, TimeNet in the United States, that DNIC would be 3106. Want to connect to Telenet in the United States? That would be 3110. What about the United States Treasury Department? Well, that was at 3166. Basically, DNICs allowed you to jump from one X25 network to another. You might be asking, well, how do you know what DNIC goes where? Well, the International Telecommunication Union, or the ITU, kept a master list of DNICs that you could download. And this information was also widely available in zines like FRAC and other hack freak kind of BBSs. Number four, an NUA, or a network user address. You also hear it referred to as a NUA. This was a target address of the system that you want to connect to. Now, typically, if you're on the same network as the system that you were targeting, you didn't have to worry about DNIC and all that business. DNICs were for network-to-network communications. So if you were connected to a Telenet pad and the system that you want to connect to is also on Telenet, some of the example NUAs you might enter would be 202255, which was Morgan Stanley, 202365, which was LexisNexis, a legal research system, or 213122, which was a Unix system operated by Computer Vision Los Angeles District Admin System, or 212-2061, which was Boston Safe Deposit and Trust Company. Now, something about these examples I was giving, if you're a phone freak, you might have noticed that the first three digits on Telenet, reasonable MPAs or area codes, that's because the Telenet NUA structure was modeled around the area code system. So if you were a hacker and you wanted to scan all of the systems in New York City that were associated with Telenet's X25 network, you would simply start at the NUA 2121, then 2122, 2123, all the way up to 2129999999. So it made it very easy to scan and find different types of systems on Telenet. NUAs also had a concept that I can only describe of as ports. They work similar to how TCP/IP ports work on the internet. To give you an example of how ports work, let's use the LexisNexis NUA of 202.365. As an X25 hacker, you might want to try something like 202.365.1 or 202.365.2. In some cases, these ports might allow you to connect to debugging facilities on the target host. Now, not all systems out there were labeled in the NPA area code way. So for instance, on Telenet, there was a huge banking firm called Citicorp, which had its own NUA ranges, which were started with 223 and 224. So for example, 223.1.0.0.0 was a cash management system at CitiCash, and 223.223 was Citibank of Citicorp. And some NUAs would do this weird thing where it would redirect you to other NUAs, which would reveal the true NUA. And that's how I would stumble on things like Citicorp. So you would connect to, say, 212, blah, 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 blah. And then it would redirect you to a 223 address. And then you would see this happen as it would as the connection was being established. And then you would see that and immediately know, wow, there's a whole range that maybe that I don't know of. And there were other ones as well, like NASA and whatnot had their own particular ranges. So you might be wondering how DNIX and NUAs work together. Well, let's pretend that we're sitting at a computer in Germany connected via an X28 pad to DataXP. The DNIC in Germany is 2624, is where we're coming from. And I want to connect to Boston Safe Deposit and Trust Company on Telenet in the United States. Telenet's DNIC is 3110. The target NUA on Telenet for Boston Safe Deposit and Trust Company is 212.2061. We would have to instruct the DataXP pad to connect to DNIC 3110 with an NUA of 212.2061. Basically, connect to 3110 212.2061. If you have the access, your connection will whiz across the globe and connect you to Boston Safe Deposit and Trust. This is what our friend Hans, also known as Pango, was doing, and we'll be talking to him later on in the show. And number 5, mnemonics. Of course, you remember all these numbers was a pain, so some X25 networks allowed you to assign names to numbers. You can think of it as DNS for X25 networks. So rather than instructing the pad to connect to a NUA, a numeric NUA, you might simply tell the pad connect to mail or a company name. Many hackers in the United States were sort of accidentally introduced to X25 networks by a service known as PC Pursuit. This service would allow you for a flat monthly fee to use outdial modems around the United States. Here, I'll let Jay Falcon explain.
You have to call into your local dial-up, and then you have to log in. You know, it says terminal equals D1, and then you start typing in your user identifier. Which is a numerical identifier plus a passcode. It's like comma passcode, anyways. And then you're logged in. Then you would start for you to use the PC Pursuit side of it. You start saying like connect to ILCHI for Chicago, Illinois, or for WASCE or WASCE for Seattle.
So for like WASCE, would you actually do like C space WASCE? Would you have to enter the command on the pad?
Yeah. Once you log in, it presents like another at sign. And right. Then that's the at sign's your prompt. And then you would, there's certain commands. You say C for connect, D for disconnect. If you manage to break out of that session. There's a whole bunch of terminal settings that you can do to the pad, but and I didn't start messing with that immediately. I mean, once you start using the outdial system and start figuring out, then you've hit all the boards, like okay, well, great, everybody's using it. You have a lot of busy, because you're not going to always be able to take full advantage of it because people are calling into these bulletin boards and. Right. You know, we have like maybe one or two lines.
Right.
So in between those times, you're still sitting at a prompt. and if when you're still dialed in, and
right,
that's when you start, you know, start looking around.
Hackers outside of the United States saw X25 networks as kind of global access points. Their perspective was slightly different. Here, I'll let Hans explain.
Yeah, that XP was the entry network that we used to go into the global X25 networks back then.
Okay.
But to us, I mean, we were living in a highly regulated environment, so there were no other offerings of X25. It was just a public phone public service, like the phone service, and so we didn't have a choice of using one or the other. There was .xp, and that was it.
In case you're wondering, Hans was known as Pengo and was a hacker in the 1980s in Berlin, Germany. Hans, Marcus, and a gentleman named Carl were central figures in a book called The Cuckoo's Egg by Clifford Stoll. You see, back in the 1980s, they were using X25 networks to break into U.S. military computers, along with other systems as well. If you haven't read The Cuckoo's Egg, I would highly, highly recommend it. It's a really, really good read. Here's Hans explaining it in his own words about how that all took place.
The story that kind of made me, in a sense, famous was that even though we didn't really have access to sensitive information, we had we always had the notion that we were kind of a very, very small group of people that could what you would call surf the networks. Back in say 1987 or 1988, because we really were a very small group, and even though we didn't really know how many other people there were, it was quite clear that the general public didn't really know what we were doing. So there was this group of people who then got in touch with a representative of what was then called the KGB, that was interested in buying software from us, in particular software, because they couldn't access software, Western software, even though they needed it, because they'd cloned all the vaccine and all the hardware that the West had. And that was kind of blown up into a story about military espionage and so on and so forth. It was really blown up more than it was in the first place. And what it served for, I mean, I'm not denying that I have been talking to a Russian at one instance, but from the perspective of what we really did and how it was perceived in the public, there is quite some difference in what we really did and what the public was told that we could potentially do. So the whole story was also blown up to, well, raise awareness, if you will.
Yeah.
And that's quite understandable. So that's my backstory, if you will, or what happened out of that being an X25 hacker back in the day.
As Hans mentioned, there was a small group of people who were known as X25 hackers. You have to keep in mind, this is the 1980s. People barely knew what modems were. And X25 networks were about as exotic as you could get. The general public didn't even know that these networks existed. And even in the hacker community, a lot of people weren't actively exploring these networks a lot. So this was a very small group of hackers that were doing this sort of thing. Now, at about this time, X28 dial-ups were operating at 300 to 1200 baud. Keep in mind, the X28 dial-up will get you to a pad, which will get you on the X25 network. The baud rates would later on increase and be up to 24 to 9600 baud, but around this time, it was usually about 300 to 1200 baud. The first thing you had to do was establish a connection to the network. In my case, finding an X28 dial-up was pretty easy. Most companies had this kind of information published, or you could find it on hacker bulletin boards. Here's Hans explaining how he accessed his X28 dial-up in Berlin, Germany.
You wanted to talk about X25, so let me yeah, explain how that worked from our end. the way how we would start accessing that would be through acoustic couplers at 300 bits per second. So acoustic coupler is something, you have a phone, a regular phone with a line on the other end, a wired phone. Nobody knows that today. And it had that specific handset with a specific form. And there was a device called an acoustic coupler where you could put in the headset instead of holding it to your head. And this handset, in the acoustic coupler would then be used to transfer bits. And because that was done acoustically, hence acoustic coupler, there was a lot, shouting in the room where someone was using the network was really disturbing your connection, because it was actual tones that were sent through the phone line. And the speed was ridiculously low, so acoustic coupler either would be 300 bits per second, 30 characters per second, or there was also an asynchronous mode in Germany that was kind of popular, which was 1200 downstream and 75 bits upstream, under the assumption that you would type slow and want to get your data from your host fast. So with this acoustic coupler, you could, you put it into your phone, you put your handset into your acoustic coupler, and then you dial a number to connect to a host. And the first thing that we did was connect to hosts that were in our city, so like our university computers, mostly university computers. But then we found out that there was this public network, and this public network, this public X25 network called .xp, would also have a local dial-in number that you would call, you would get a simple command line interface, if you will. And before you could really make a connection into another system through the X25 network, it was basically a gateway, you had to identify yourselves using a network user identification, NUI. So having a NUI, that's what we call it, NUI. Do you have a NUI? Was like the common question among people in that era. With that NUI, you would indicate who would be paying for the connection, and the payment was based on packets. So every packet that you send, no matter how many bytes of the 64 maximum bytes of a packet that you would use, would cost you like 0.02 cents or whatever. So if you had a NUI, so you would connect to that DatXP gateway and then enter your NUI de blah blah, and you had to enter a password, and then with that you could enter a number, and that number could be either a German number starting with 445 or 44, depending on the type of host that you wanted to connect to, or it could be an international number starting with 0, like 03110, that would be Telenet in the United States, or 03106 would be Timenet, or 0228 would be Switzerland. So you could basically, like in the phone system, dial to systems that would be located around the world. With the bill being paid by the owner of the NUI that you had. And in particular, international connections were kind of expensive. So of course, our initial criminal motivation was to figure out NUIs that someone else would pay for so that we could surf the net for free. And that was mostly, either someone knew someone at a company and they were not very well, they didn't really know that this would costly and then give it away. And we even had a NUI that had that we later found out was paid for by DEC. And oftentimes you would go to a trade fair like CeBIT and look at booths to see whether someone was using .xp and spy their passwords. So that was a very, very early form of stealing passwords.
In the 1980s, dialing into X25 networks was similar in the United States that Hans describes dialing into X25 networks in Berlin. In the United States, NUIs were a valuable commodity, but not necessarily needed as they were for Hans. Around the same time Hans was describing, I was also experimenting with X25 networks. The difference was, for me, is that I had a 300 baud auto-dial modem. This meant that I didn't have the same hassles or headaches that Hans had with acoustic couplers. Like Hans, I would dial into an X28 pad using a local phone number. Different X25 networks might act differently upon dial-up. Some might ask you for a terminal type or possibly some other identification information. You typically found out about an X28 pad dial-up from other hackers or hacker zines like FRAC or something like that, or even the company or organization that might operate the X25 network itself. So now you're connected to the X25 network via the X28 pad. The next step as a hacker is to find targets on that network. This typically involved playing with and learning some of the basics of the X25 network that you were connected to. So for example, on whatever X25 network you were on, you needed a basic understanding how the networks and UAs were laid out. Some of this information was available in hacker zines and X25 network documentation, if you could get your hands on that sort of thing. In my case, at this period of time, I loved to play with Telenet and TimeNet. Telenet NUAs were pretty straightforward, as I discussed earlier in the show. Many people relied on NUAs published in FRAC and other hacker magazines. I always wanted to search out for the unknown stuff that was connected to Telenet, so I started to write my own scanners. At a pretty young age, I started programming, and it's always been a fun passion of mine. So around this time, after I understood how NUAs worked on Telenet, it felt almost natural just to write an NUA scanner. One of the scanners that I wrote was called T-Scan around this time, and it worked with MS-DOS and was written in QBASIC 4.5, and it worked like this. You would tell T-Scan what serial port or COM port your modem was located on. If a modem could be found on that COM port, it would tell the modem to dial into the Telenet X28 pad. This was all done via the modem's Hayes command set. So essentially, T-Scan would send a ATDT or attention modem dial tone and the phone number of the X28 pad. In most cities, Telenet actually had multiple dial-up phone numbers to get access to an X28 pad. So actually what T-Scan would do was pick one of them at random to dial into. The idea here was not to raise suspicion from the X25 network operators by repeatedly dialing into the same X28 pad and phone number. Once connected, T-Scan would wait for certain types of prompts. For example, the X28 pad would ask for a terminal type, and T-Scan would respond with D1. T-Scan knew it was at the pad prompt when it reached the lone at symbol command prompt. This is where commands could be entered on the pad. T-Scan would then enter a base NUA that I wanted to scan. So for example, let's say I wanted to scan Washington DC NUAs. In the United States, the area code for Washington DC is 202. T-Scan would send C202000001. The C being short for connect. And then it would wait and see what the X25 network returned. After that, it would send C202000002, and then C202000003. And you kind of get the picture. After it sent the NUA, it would watch for the return results. It would obviously record any time the target NUA connected to something. It would also record refuse collect calls. This meant that there was something there, but it would require an NUI to connect to it. We would record this because it might be useful at a later date. Usually after about a dozen or so NUA attempts, the X28 pad would eventually just kick you off and hang up on you. This was done because the X28 pad didn't see you doing anything useful on the network. When that happened, T-Scan would wait a random short period of time, again, to fly under the radar of the X25 network administrators and dial back into a random X28 pad phone number. From here, for T-Scan, it's just repeat and rinse. From my standpoint, I would let T-Scan run day and night for days and days at a time. When I would get home from school or whatever it was, I would pause T-Scan and pore over the results. On weekends, I would stay up late at night looking at banners that had been recorded from different systems that were found by T-Scan, and even connect up to Telenet and manually connect to these systems and play with them. And I have to say, it was a complete blast. One thing that I found out during the production of this show and interviewing people is that I was likely one of the few people who was actively scanning X25 networks at this particular time. Many, like my buddy Jay Falcon here, use publishing UAs from hacker zines.
The only information I knew of from about what else you can even do with packet with X25 networks was from FRAC or from whatever text files what people would put up. But not many people were doing it. You know, it was just... And, you know, when you did read about the information, you're maybe either the information was maybe a little bit old or maybe you discovered it a little bit too late.
Here's Hans talking about issues scanning X25 networks from Berlin.
We did not have modems. We really had acoustic couplers back then. So, and that means no dialing. We had to dial ourselves, and if the pad disconnected us, it disconnected us. Right. So and I mean, you of course in the United States you would have free local calls, so you call your
right. True. Pad. Good point.
Yeah, and you would just redial and that's it. But to us it was expensive. So our optimization target was to either use the pad connection as long as we could. Or better yet, use a host in the network to scan, because that would be faster and more reliable anyway. So that was kind of the idea.
So you've done your scans, and now you want to start targeting systems connected to the X25 network that you've identified. The technique that you would use to attack these type of systems largely depended on the targets themselves. So, for example, if it were some type of Unix system, you might try usernames like sync or UUCP. In many cases, these accounts did not have passwords and would let you log into the Unix system just long enough to see and look at the, quote, message of the day. Basically, this was the etc/motd file. This might give you some more information or hints about who operated the system or other ways you may be able to further penetrate into the system. Of course, you would also try the root account as well in hopes that the administrators were using weak passwords there. If your target happened to be a VMS system, which was an operating system made by Digital Equipment Corporation and one of my favorite targets at the time, you might try default usernames like field with the password of service. If or when those failed, then you would see if you could find a guest or demo account that you could crack. If the system was connected and displayed something like a node name for that particular system, you try that even as a username and password. It was astonishing to me how often just using the node name as a username and password would work to break into systems as well. Basically, all the computer systems that you would run into had their own techniques that you might try. So, for example, if you ran into a DEC terminal server or a Xiplex terminal server, you try to default for the setpriv command of system. The system was the password. You ran into a prime, that would be another set of techniques that you'd use specifically to attack prime machines. So, yep. Default accounts and weak passwords have been a problem in the security industry for about 30 plus years now, and that still has not changed. Here's Hans talking about hacking VMS systems on X25 networks.
I mean, I had my list of things that I was trying. In the very first days when VMS2 was still out there, or 3, I think 3 was the one that also had sys-test and sys-test UETP,
yes,
foolproof accounts. But then what was very popular was also having a visitor account. So, and visitor as username, I think it's pretty much a British word. Mm-hmm. Or at least I have seen that a lot in Europe and not so much in the United States. So visitor always also often worked, but getting access through either proxy access from in the HapNet environment or stealing passwords from emails, that was really then the most fruitful way of doing stuff.
After the compromise, you would usually attempt to backdoor the system that you broke into. Not all the time, but sometimes. This was usually accomplished by recording passwords or running software that would let you back into the system at a later date. Just like today, hackers back then would attempt to hide the compromise as well. Here's Hans discussing backdooring a VMS system and how they used to do it.
Yeah, well, that thing, that was a patch to login out that was done by someone in Karlsruhe, I think. And that was very, very popular because basically what it did was it wrote down the password when you logged in. When someone logged in, it wrote down the password in clear text so that we could then grab that from a file. So that was happening, sure.
So were you involved in that, like where, say, you would compromise the system, and you'd have to have like system administrator, like you'd have to be system, wouldn't you, to patch the login?
Yeah, of course, but it would still be interesting to have the password because then the other system. So that's what we did, evening I was hacking about in a system in I think it was in England, and someone phoned me that I didn't know and identified themselves as another hacker, a British hacker. He said, well, he said he was from Great Britain and blah blah blah, and we talked a bit, and then he gave me a little hint saying that there was this bit in the process header called Delpen, and I should have a look at that. So I that was really fun because I mean it was a very, very specific bit of information that this stranger gave me, knowing that I was another hacker, and I had the impression that this guy really knew a lot and wanted to just, well, here, little guy, I have something for you. But it was really an interesting information because I then figured out what this bit is. It is a bit in the process header that tells the system that your process is being deleted or that this process is being deleted. So if you set this, well, usually to delete a process, the system would set the bit and then initiate the deletion by setting ASTs or arranging that the process would die eventually. But if you set the bit and don't do that, then your process would become invisible and also unkillable. And that was really a nice tool because I figured out how to set that bit in using a change multi-kernel blah blah macro 32 program, and I had a tool that basically made me invisible on machines where I had all privileges, and that was fun.
Believe it or not, it wasn't uncommon to run into other hackers on X25 networks. And when you did, you'd usually strike up a conversation with them. And a lot of times these conversations would lead to trading information and accounts. On X25 networks, there were even chat systems that were very similar to what IRC is today. And many hackers all over the world would connect to these X25 chat systems and chat on them and exchange information about what they were doing. Unfortunately for me, I never had the opportunity to explore those chat systems. It just arrived too late. So what happened to X25 networks? Well, a larger, more successful network came along known as the Internet. And as the Internet grew, many X25 networks stopped accepting new nodes on their network. It quickly became apparent to me and Jay Falcon around 2005 that these networks were going to die out. With this in mind, we made a push to do a final exploration of these networks. It was sort of our last chance to play with them before they got unplugged and these networks were extinct forever. However, we had one big advantage in 2005 that we didn't in 1987. Phone calls were now really cheap. In fact, with things like voice over IP and the internet, it was incredibly cheap. So Jay Falcon and I took out our modems and started playing and looking for X28 pad dial-ups around the world. And yes, modems over VoIP do work. Remember, we're still talking about pretty low speeds here, but it is completely possible to do. Anyways, from that research, we started dialing to X28 pads around the world, in places like Rosnet in Russia and iNet in India and Datapack in Canada and even DataXP in Germany one last time.
There was news about the last, I believe it was TimeNet node being shut down about 6 months ago and whatnot. I wonder how much is still out there. You know what I mean? Like that is... I'm not talking about radio where it's AX25, which is like
a subset.
I'm talking about like traditional companies using X25.
If companies haven't, you know, just speaking from my experience with it as in my professional life, I think if companies aren't switching over from X25 or doing some kind of XOT conversion, which would be like the bare minimum. Because you know, no one really is putting tons and tons of money into buying big, you know, mini computers, mainframes, and stuff like that anymore. That's what X25 was more akin to that, because it's from that same era of computing.
But let's face it, X25 is practically dead at this point. But it was a lot of fun while it lasted. If you're interested in seeing the talk that Jay Falcon and I gave at Hackers on Planet Earth, aka HOPE, back in July of 2008 in New York City, just go to YouTube and search for Hacking International Networks Using VoIP. It's usually the first hit on that type of search. I really, really hope that you have enjoyed this episode of Demodulate, the first episode. The next one that I'm going to be doing is very, very special to me. Here's a little hint.
This one is about X25. The next one's going to be about war dialing. I probably should have switched that around. Now, the war dialing one, I will be calling you again, by the way. I figured you probably knew that already.
Oh, yeah.
So my friend here, Jay Falcon, has dialed more phone numbers in more countries than any person that I know. And I've dialed a hell of a lot of phone numbers in my time. I'd like to thank Hans, aka Pango, and Mr. Jay Falcon for letting me interview them for this show. If you are interested in listening to the full interviews of either of these gentlemen, they're available at demodulate.io. If you have any questions or comments about the show, please feel free to hit me up by email at beave@demodulate.io. That's BEAVE at demodulate.io. You can also hit me up on Twitter. My Twitter handle is dabeave, dabeave 666. And feel free to hit me up there. This has been a Telefreak production.